The attack on the TV station, I think, accomplished what the organizers set out to do, which was to terrify the population and illustrate to political leaders how much power and how much brazen force the gangs could exercise. So, yes, the individuals who stormed that station were arrested, and the prison riots in general in the country were pacified, arrests were made. But this is not the core issue. The core issue is that Ecuador is now a center for the international drug trade and the violence that comes with it.
How can I help? How can I be useful in ending needless suffering? Do not be afraid of work that has no end.
We have to organize a social movement.
We have an opportunity to lead by example versus just talking, hot air. I think the more people in this fight, the more we grow. Eventually, it could change. You know, the people are the ones that can make the change.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Change Agents, an Ironclad original presented by Montana Knife Company. Today's episode is about Ecuador's drastic shift from a period of relative peace to experiencing severe gang violence and criminal activities, highlighting the country's current security crisis. Ecuador has had one of the lowest murder rates in the region, but the homicide rate has increased by 500% since 2018. From 2022 to 2023 alone, Ecuador's murder rate nearly doubled. A 2023 United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime report found that both cocaine consumption and production are at record levels. And in 2022, nearly 18,000 Ecuadorians sought asylum in the U.S., a five-fold increase from the previous year. My guest today to discuss this issue is Carl David Getty Lutsiak. He is a reporter for the Latin American Advisor and a freelance writer for publication outlets such as Vox, The Guardian, and The Washington Post. He has extensive experience reporting on civil conflict, politics, and corruption from Central America. Can you paint a picture for me of maybe the situation in Ecuador a decade ago, maybe two decades ago, versus the situation that is emerging now?
Yeah, well, I mean, both of those are very different time periods for both the state of Ecuador's political system, its economy, and day-to-day life for most Ecuadorians. So two decades ago, Ecuador was really hailed as one of these islands of peace in a region that was characterized by armed conflict, by violence linked to narco-trafficking, and by also persistent economic problems. Ecuador, you know, had a flourishing economy, which hit a crisis in the years that followed. And a decade ago, you're looking at a country that is suffering economically and struggling to finance a lot of the programs and services of its public sector. But it's still relatively stable in terms of the issues of violence and organized crime that have plagued its Andean neighbors. Of course, organized crime does exist in Ecuador during this period, but the violence and the impact on quality of life is not there. So Guayaquil, for instance, is still a beautiful seaside town and a lovely place to visit as a tourist. And really, this all changes in 2020. And in the years since then, you've seen car bombings, assassinations, beheadings and the stringing up of victims from bridges, like something from Juarez a decade or so ago, and just an explosion of violence that's driven by gangs, and particularly on Ecuador's coast. The capital of Quito, in many ways, is isolated from a lot of this, but the coastal area of Ecuador has really been transformed, and the lives of ordinary citizens there have changed dramatically in the course of such a short span of time that I think it's really disorienting, not only to, you know, analysts and writers and journalists outside, but also to average people living in many of the coastal cities of Ecuador.
Yeah, I can only imagine that that would be a jarring shock. Just out of curiosity, what first piqued your attention about Ecuador? How did it hit your radar as a journalist?
I've always been interested in writing about Ecuador, about its economic problems earlier. But for the last several years, I've really been writing and focusing specifically on this. And for a number of years, I was writing about how Ecuador was a tinderbox that was set to explode, because you saw these worrying signs. In Guayaquil, suddenly the escalation of the conflict between the gangs involved bombings of entire apartment complexes just to try to assassinate one major figure. And this was really out of sync and a huge departure and outlier from what violence had looked like in that region previously. And a lot of the indications pointed to kind of a singular event in 2020, in which the leader of the largest organized crime group, the largest domestic organized crime group in Ecuador, the Choneros, the leader was assassinated in 2020. And what was apparent from the outside even then was that this had sparked a power struggle within splinter factions of that organization. But what's become increasingly clear in the years since is that it's not just that battle between different factions of the Choneros, but also a whole host of international criminal organizations, money, arms, and connections that have fed into not a proxy conflict, but have transformed the nature of violence and conflict in Ecuador, particularly on the coast.
Is it largely based just due to the narco economy, maybe not necessarily in Ecuador, but it's obviously sandwiched in between Peru and Colombia, which, I mean, let's be honest, one of their main exports is cocaine.
Well, yeah, of course, absolutely. So, I mean, this is not really an Ecuadorian problem. This is the latest manifestation of a regional, if not the international problem, which is the cocaine trade. So Ecuador has never been a large producer of cocaine. That's produced primarily, of course, in Colombia, as well as in Peru and in Bolivia. But Ecuador has always been a strategic transshipment point for cocaine. And in the last decades, a lot of cocaine was traveling directly from Colombia by various overseas and air routes to the United States. But in the last about 10 years, there's been a really big shift with drug consumption and with the profit motive for drug trafficking. And that is that American drug consumers have increasingly turned towards opiates and towards methamphetamine, and drug consumption in Europe has exploded. So from 2016, I think just till 2020, the seizures of cocaine in ports like Rotterdam and the Netherlands has quadrupled, indicating this massive jump in the consumption of cocaine and in the demand for cocaine in Europe. And this has meant that the nature of the cocaine trade has shifted, and the emphasis, while of course there continues to be an enormous amount of trafficking in the United States, the real money lies in shipping cocaine to Europe. And with a Colombian prop plane, you cannot fly, you know, from Bogota to Amsterdam. So this means that the primary route in which cocaine is smuggled to Europe is through shipping containers. And in Ecuador, the port of Guayaquil is an incredibly strategic transshipment point to Europe. And there's a lot of opportunity, particularly because of the export of bananas. Which, you know, it's a bit specific and funny, but containerized bananas have to be loaded and have to be unloaded very quickly. So The capacity for authorities, both in Ecuador and in the European ports to which these containers travel, to check all of this is limited. And an enormous amount of cocaine is now smuggled to European consumers through containerized bananas on international shipping lines.
What kept Ecuador out of the cocaine production industry? I'm assuming, I'm not an expert in the geography of the region, but does it have the same climate and growing ability as, let's say, Colombia and Peru on the, you know, the northeast and the southern borders?
The development of Ecuador's trade in drugs really has to do more with the establishment of the principal powers. So In the 1990s, for example, the cocaine trade in that region was really very strongly controlled by the FARC in Colombia. And in Peru as well, these sort of established guerrilla armies that created deeper links with narco trafficking organizations and engaged in the drug trade allowed for this expansion of the business. But these were regimented, incredibly well-organized armies and criminal operations. And Ecuador did not develop these kinds of groups. In part, I think also because economic conditions in Ecuador during the 1990s and 2000s were much better. So it was harder to draw in desperate young people who were looking to criminal enterprise to sustain themselves and their family. And so Ecuador has always been crucial and central in the drug trade, but not in the production of drugs. And in terms of the nature of violence and power, Ecuador's homeborn criminal organizations were largely partners to these larger international organizations, principally, of course, the FARC from Colombia, until 2016 when the FARC demobilized. And this created a real turning point in Ecuador and in the drug trade in general from that point onwards.
Yeah, and fast forwarding now, I think a lot of people in the Western world would probably struggle to find Ecuador on a map. They probably don't hear very often about breaking news in Ecuador. But one thing I do remember seeing myself happened actually in January, and it was a video of an armed gang taking over a TV broadcast studio. I believe they were live at the time in Ecuador. Can you talk about what actually happened there, what led up to that, and what they were trying to achieve by doing so?
What happened that day, and it was January 9, so not very long ago, is an event I think that will be remembered by, certainly all of the television viewers in Ecuador who are tuning into that program. And I think will mark kind of a historic turning point in the history of the country and the way that people remember it, because it was this very sort of dramatic wake-up call. So in the immediate days preceding that, Daniel Noboa, who won an election and took office in November to serve out an interim presidency, the remainder of Guillermo Lasso's term, he's pursued sort of a more stringent and aggressive security policy. And early January, January 4th, I believe, he declared that he had plans to construct two new maximum security prisons, using the same company and design of the jails created in El Salvador as part of Bukele's security crackdown, and signaled that he was, going to try to transform prison policy and security policy. And then a few days later, on January 7th, the current leader of the Choneros, a man named José Adolfo Macias, better known as Fito, escaped from prison. And this was, one of the key, if not the most important leader of organized crime in Ecuador. And plans had been to transfer him to another more secure prison. And instead, clearly, through corruption and with information that should not have been accessible to him, he instead was able to escape. And in response to that, on January 8th, the president Noboa declared a state of exception and mobilized the military in a hunt for him. And this set off a series of massive prison riots around the country. And that led on January 9th, then to an escalation of gang attacks across the country. And this saw them invade hospitals, universities, carry out bombings and shootings. And in the most traumatic of these attacks, a group of armed men stormed this live television broadcast in Ecuador. And this was really a show of power from the gangs, illustrating that, they are now political players and can push back against the security policies of the state and flex their own muscle. And this has led to sort of this current push by the government with the president declaring the same day of these massive attacks that the country was in a state of internal armed conflict. And he designated the nation's criminal organizations, 22 or so gangs, as terrorist groups, and has begun sort of a new phase of an attempted security crackdown in Ecuador.
I hope you are enjoying season 2 of Change Agents, which is an Ironclad original. And if you are a fan of the podcast, you know that we are presented by Montana Knife Company, which from where I am sitting right now is a short 2-hour drive, maybe 120 miles due south towards Missoula. I was first exposed to this brand through its founder, Josh Smith. And actually, when I first met him, I wasn't even aware of what Montana Knife Company was. He sat across the table from me. We had a conversation, and I have been a fan ever since. This was a few years ago, and the velocity and trajectory of that company is unbelievable. I directly associate that growth with who Josh is, what he stands for, and what he puts into his product. So a little bit more about Josh. He's been making knives for 30 years. They're made in the USA. They have a multi-generational warranty and free sharpening. They're designed, tested, and they're built by hunters, and MKC's a hunting knife company first and foremost. They sell out their knives sometimes in under 60 seconds. And if you want to see what they have available or what's coming up, surf over to MontanaKnifeCompany.com. They have a new knife drop every Thursday at 7 p.m. Here's what I'm going to say on that. Practice checking out. As ridiculous as that sounds, you need to have your credit card information loaded and practice the checkout process, because they go like that. I cannot even count the number of times I have had a knife taken from my cart because somebody was faster to purchase it than I was. People ask me all the time, what's my favorite blade of theirs? I go with the Mini Speed Go. It is my everyday carry knife. I don't use it for knife fighting. I use it for things that I need a knife for, so usually opening boxes. But it is my favorite blade, and if you're a fan of working knives made for working people, I highly suggest that you check out Montana Knife Company. And I'm going to add to that, let's talk a little bit about the warranty. They have the best warranty program in the industry. No matter if you bought the knife from them directly, or bought the knife from a friend, or it was gifted to you, or if you even found the knife, they're going to honor the warranty for the life of the blade. How awesome is that? Couldn't be more proud to have them as the presenting sponsor of Change Agents. They are a fantastic organization. How did they eventually quell what could only be described as those coordinated attacks? I was doing a little bit of research on the group of individuals that came into the news studio. I don't believe there was a loss of life. Please correct me if I'm wrong, because it talked about in what I could find that they were taken into custody.
Yes.
Was it a show that they were basically giving a warning, like, hey, if we continue down this path, these are going to escalate, and then they surrendered? Or how was that? Because what you're talking about is very coordinated. If we're going to hospitals and schools and events all in the same day and likely at the same time period, I'm curious how they were able to get control of that.
It was coordinated. And the attack on the TV station, I think, accomplished what the organizers set out to do, which was to terrify the population and illustrate to political leaders how much power and how much brazen force the gangs could exercise. So yes, the individuals who stormed that station were arrested, and the prison riots in general in the country were pacified, arrests were made, but this is not the core issue. The core issue is that Ecuador is now a center for the international drug trade and the violence that comes with it. And the conflict between armed groups inside that country is not only going to continue to lead to widespread violence, but may indeed escalate. And although right now we've seen a big drop in violence, there's a lot of indications that this larger problem is still there. And whether gangs have decided to take a strategic retreat, whether there's been some kind of negotiation with the government, there's no evidence of that, but it's a tactic that's been pursued by Latin American leaders in the past. I think most analysts would agree that these forces are lying in wait and can continue to carry out these attacks or exercise power in whatever way they want to in the near future.
Does Ecuador itself have the tools to deal with their capability? You know, declaring an organization a terrorist organization is one thing. Having the police force or federal government abilities to actually do something about it is a very different thing.
Absolutely not. But that said, you know, the problems that that affect Ecuador's military and its judiciary and its police are issues that affect many countries. But the idea that sending in the military, and this is what's happened. So, you know, over the last several weeks and months, there are military patrols, particularly in coastal cities like Guayaquil that are so central in the drug trade. There's curfews, there are checkpoints, there's been mass raids and operations, the arrest, I think now of around 11,000 people since this crackdown began in January. But the real core issue in Ecuador is that the money, influence, and power which organized crime in that country has amassed has already wrapped its tentacles and its roots into the police force, the military, into the prison system, into the judiciary, into the National Assembly, even. And one of the big indications of this is the Attorney General has pursued this case that she calls the metastasis investigations. And this has been a case built around phone records from drug traffickers and leaders of organized crime that have implicated a number of judges, including the previous head of Ecuador's prison system, a member of the National Assembly, I believe, as well, and resulted in the arrest of something like 30 government officials. And it's still ongoing. So you see evidence that Ecuador's institutions have already in many ways been co-opted by the narco traffickers and the gangs that the state is seeking to suppress. So when you send the military into prisons, what is really being accomplished? Last month, you know, the military was sent in and was able to pacify these prisons in which there were riots. But last month, there was an enormous cache of weapons that was found in one of Guayaquil's prisons, indicating, of course, that the military presence there has not ended the control of the gangs. And a point that one of the people I interviewed for the piece I wrote for Vox, Daniela Chacon, former vice mayor of Quito, really pressed on this point that the gangs are in control of the prison system. How else could, you know, this top leader, the most wanted criminal in Ecuador, Fito, walk out of jail? And 2 days later, his rival, the leader of the Tiburones gang, also just simply left prison because they run the prisons and they continue to run their criminal enterprises from there. So, you know, pouring military into the streets, sending gang members to prisons, if the structural issues are not fixed, I don't think that that solves the core issues that Ecuador is facing.
You know, I've been very fortunate to host quite a few episodes specifically on drug cartels in Mexico and their influence. And the language that you are using, the situation that you are describing, whether it's at the lowest levels of law enforcement, the highest levels of police, the court systems, the politicians, the corruption and their influence in there, it is eerily similar to what you hear about the power of the drug cartels in Mexico.
It's not similar. It's the same. The drug cartels of Mexico are operating in Ecuador. You know, there's almost an error we make linguistically when we talk about Mexican drug cartels, because in truth, these are transnational, international criminal operations, some of the largest businesses in the world in terms of international trade and the shipment of cocaine. And as Ecuador has become the center of one of the centers of global narco trafficking because of its importance as a transshipment point to Europe, Mexican cartels have set up shop there. And a lot of this, again, develops and escalates after the FARC's demobilization in 2016. Their control of the drug trade meant that when the FARC demobilized, much of the FARC demobilized, a power vacuum was created. And into that power vacuum stepped a number of groups, Venezuelan gangs. The Albanian mob actually has an enormous foothold in Guayaquil. But Mexican cartels also entered the picture. And the Choneros allied themselves with the Sinaloa cartel. And the splinter factions of the Choneros that broke off as profit surged in the country and led to an internecine conflict for the leadership of that organization. A number of groups split off. The Tiburones, the Lobos, the Pipos, and they allied with the Jalisco Nueva Generación cartel. And so this old drug war and cartel conflict that we think of as Mexican between Sinaloa and Jalisco is now the same, very same conflict that's playing out in Ecuador. And the escalation of violence between these Ecuadorian groups is being fed by arms, by money, and by training from Mexican cartels themselves.
For the Mexican cartels, do they have physical presence there, or is it more of allegiance? And I ask that question because, again, we've talked about how the European market is a little bit more on the botanical side, whereas the American market has seemed to switch a little bit more towards the synthetic, so a difference in trade. But those Mexican cartels, I mean, there's obviously a few countries in between, you know, that southern tail of Mexico as it works its way down to South America. Do they control, if they wanted to, do they control a route all the way up through Mexico? Or are they leapfrogging over those countries and just controlling it from, you know, training, expertise, control of the ports, and that type of influence and control?
There's a lot of indications that members of Mexican cartels are indeed operating themselves in Ecuador, though I think the indirect influence of money, power, and direction is probably the more important factor. Because in Ecuador, due to a prolonged economic crisis that's plunged thousands of people into poverty, there's ample recruitment grounds for young men hoping to support themselves and their family. So with money and organizational structures, it's not hard to build a new criminal organization there. But yeah, evidence points to the fact that both the Jalisco Nueva Generación cartel and the Sinaloa cartel are deeply intertwined with members of the Ecuadorian organized crime groups that operate there domestically. And again, while these groups are involved in trafficking over land and by air to the United States, the centrality of Ecuador is really about control of the port, which is why so much of this violence is centered in Guayaquil, the major port city in Ecuador.
That makes sense. Even rolling into this week, the week of March 25th, I have a note in front of me here. Ecuador's youngest mayor, correct me if I'm saying this wrong, Bridget Garcia, was shot dead, which is... I mean, that's an escalation of political violence for sure. Is this something that is new to the violence scope and scale of Ecuador as well, that has accelerated beyond 2020?
Yeah, well, it's new, relatively speaking. Again, the idea of political assassinations and car bombings and gruesome public murders, this was all very foreign. For Ecuador, only a few years ago, you know, these were things that people associated with Colombia, with Mexico, to some extent with Peru. But since 2020 and the beginning of this real internecine conflict between factions of Ecuador's organized crime, this has all exploded. And again, with the influx of money from the cocaine trade, these crime groups have become more and more enmeshed with politics and have attempted to start exercising more political power. And with that comes political assassinations. So Brigitte Garcia, who was just murdered, is one of a series of tragedies. I don't think she's, in the last year, I think there's been at least one other mayor who was killed and a mayoral candidate that was assassinated. And perhaps the most notable murder was last year, an incredibly brave man, Fernando Villavicencio, who was an investigative reporter who was running for president, was gunned down, I believe in August 9th of last year. And that was, you know, perhaps the most high profile political assassination. But again, who is behind these killings is difficult to establish. For instance, with Vicenio's murder, there were six Colombians who were arrested in connection with that killing, and then all of them were murdered in prison almost immediately. And Peru, in the last week or two, has carried out a series of mega raids and operations trying to track down criminals connected with that killing. So the targeting of Ecuadorian politicians is also international crime groups that are targeting Ecuadorian political figures and also surely attempting to bribe and corrupt others.
How do you think that plays out for the new president that you mentioned, Daniel Noboa? 35, he's already come out as being very anti-gang. What do you think the future holds for him?
Well, Noboa is very popular right now. I think latest polls put his approval rating at 70% or above. So the nation has really rallied around him. He's been in office a very short time. He came into office in November, and he's serving out only an interim presidency until elections can be held, because he's finishing up the term of the previous president. Noboa's security crackdown has, you know, won approval from the Ecuadorian populace, but a lot can change. You know, I think that the resumption of gang attacks and the re-escalation of violence in that country is sadly probably inevitable. And that can throw the upcoming elections certainly into question. And Noboa is going to try to win re-election. And I think his attempt to put forward a really strong security policy is also certainly part of his electoral strategy. But any number of things can destabilize or turn that entire situation on its head between now and when Ecuadorians go to the polls.
Yeah, I was just thinking about what you're talking about. You know, the popularity with the people doesn't surprise me at all. I suspect they may not have surveyed the gangs and their thoughts on his anti-gang stance. But it also might point to why they selected the institutions that they did. I believe you said it was on January 9th when it was more than just the TV station. It was the hospitals and other organizations. It seems like they were targeting institutions that perhaps people would think were more secure. And I can see a few reasons to do that, whether to show the fragility of the government or the leader in your organization, or just to show the vulnerability that most people have throughout their everyday life and that they don't want to recognize. I'm just curious your thoughts on that.
Absolutely. I think... again, I think January 9th will be remembered as a turning point in the history of Ecuador and the way that people think about the security situation and the political stability of that country, precisely because what really happened that day was Daniel Noboa had, you know, declared the state of exception and come out with this strong speech that he was going to crack down on gangs with this emergency decree and send the military in. And in response, what the gangs illustrated through their brazen attacks on public institutions, universities, this television station, in the street and in public, was to show that the government is not in control. And they wield an enormous amount of power and can completely upturn the country with a series of bombings and shootings. And what happened that day, I think, really is in many ways terrorism. It's an attempt to strike terror into the hearts of ordinary Ecuadorian citizens and demonstrate a kind of power that forces all kinds of different institutions in Ecuador to think through how they might reckon with and attempt to deal with them. And who knows, you know, a lot of this is not visible to us on a public level, whether this resulted in negotiations between government officials and gangs. But I think that demonstration of power was a way of Ecuador's criminal groups announcing that they're no longer a minor player in a struggle between the government, but that the real struggle for control of the country is now in between Ecuador's main criminal organizations and gangs.
Did it provide Ecuador, you know, the declaration of them becoming terrorist organizations, does that provide Ecuador any other tools or enhancements or aid in the region that may help fight them? Or is it literally just vernacular that has shifted?
It provides the government a number of tools, though I think many may have unintended consequences. So the declaration of internal armed conflict, the designation of these groups as terrorist organizations, the mobilization of the military allows a rollback of civil liberties and expands the capacities and the abilities of law enforcement to pursue criminals, to arrest them, and to jail them. But again, and I think John Walsh has written some really wonderful things at the Washington Office on Latin America, WOLA, about the potential for that kind of militarized approach to really put citizens in greater danger. And one of the points that he underlined to me when I talked with him is that when the state, in this example, Ecuador, attempts to roll back the safeguards, the rules and the restrictions upon state power in order to crack down on crime, it is also in many ways serving the ends of those criminal groups that hope to co-opt the state through corruption and through abuse. It opens up new avenues for those armed forces put on the streets to be corrupted in the potential event of sending innocent citizens to jail. Those jails then serve as recruitment and training centers for those same criminal organizations. And by rolling back checks and balances, you create more opportunity for the co-optation of those forces and their corruption, which is, I think, in many ways, the central issue. These gangs and criminal organizations will continue to exist for as long as it is wildly profitable to manufacture and traffic cocaine to the United States and Europe. I think the question of whether Ecuador can meaningfully address its security crisis really has to do with the strength of its institutions. And in that, I think you look not only at the capacity of the military and the leash given to law enforcement, but also the strength of the judiciary, of the executive and political branch of the legislature, of the checks and balances which maintain a democracy.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I struggle with, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, perhaps you even struggle with this as a journalist, getting people to pay attention to not only issues inside of the United States, but now let's leapfrog countries, right? South of Mexico, which most Americans, understand what's going on in Mexico. They've heard about the cartels. You continue to jump even farther south. You land yourself in Ecuador. I bet quite a few people would be familiar with what happened at the TV station. I did not realize they had stormed other institutions, so I don't think that would be a surprise to others as well. But the leap, or the difficulty, maybe that's a better word for it, is getting people to pay attention because they don't understand how what is happening in this country could potentially impact their life here in the United States. You're sitting in New York, I'm in northwestern Montana. How do we Help me connect the dots for people in, let's just talk specifically in the US, where we're both living. Why should they pay attention and why should they care about what's happening in Ecuador?
Well, I think that question is perhaps best reversed. The question is not necessarily how does violence in Ecuador impact Americans, but how do Americans and political choices in the United States impact Ecuador? Because, of course, the crisis of violence that's now afflicting cities like Guayaquil is, in many ways, a direct result of drug policy and prohibition in the United States and in Europe. There's not an enormous local consumption market in Ecuador. That business is being driven by international demand. And I think it's important to understand it not as a national problem of Ecuador's, but really an international issue. Because as long as that massive profit motive exists, and as long as that money continues to flow from consumers through traffickers into these organizations, those funds exist to corrupt institutions, to bribe politicians, and to put guns in the hands of desperate people and destroy communities. So I think the important thing is to recognize that Americans living here and political leaders in this country, as well as across the world, are intertwined with the crisis happening in Ecuador. And there is a responsibility to think about what a regional approach to that security situation would look like, because it's not entirely Ecuador's responsibility, nor is Ecuador capable of fixing that issue on its own. And a broader approach, I think, is certainly warranted.
If you had the ability to input some sweeping changes, where would you start?
Some serious questions have to be asked about drug prohibition and the drug war on a global level. I think it's important to look at the last decades of militarized approaches and policy and see what results have really been won and what puts ordinary citizens and people more at risk or less at risk. And I think the escalation of armed conflict through militarized approaches and through security crackdowns can often put local populations at greater risk of violence and abuse. So I think really examining the roots of these issues and what meaningful solutions would look like in Ecuador and beyond requires us to ask difficult questions about how we approach the global issue of narco trafficking and the violence that it brings along with it.
Do you think it's actually a solvable problem?
I don't know. It's a difficult question to ask. I think it's enormous. It's an enormous problem. And I think meaningful strides can be made to address it in better and worse ways, ones that center public safety and security more or less. And I think there are meaningful changes in policies that can be adopted in an attempt to limit violence. But again, as long as that enormous amount of money continues to flow into that trade, it's going to continue to fund and motivate violence. And security policies that attempt to address it are going to have to rely on the strength of internal institutions and to some extent also regional cooperation. There's a new initiative among the Andean community to try to attempt to address border security and the sort of transnational dimension of the crisis that Ecuador is facing. And I think that's a very positive step. The governments of Colombia and Peru should be involved in cooperation with the Ecuadorian state on what is really not Ecuador's problem, but a regional Andean problem of organizations that don't care about the borders between these countries. They operate through all of it. So having that broader approach to the issue, I think, is a good place to start.
Yeah, it's almost an unfair question to ask of you or anybody else. And, you know, younger in my life, I thought much of life itself was much more binary, very black and white, very yes and no. And I don't know if it is a solvable problem anymore. And I think perhaps a better question is, what tools could we use to manage it better? Supply and demand is a real thing in any ecosystem and in any market on the face of planet Earth. And as long as people have the choice or the desire to consume these things or use these things to manage whatever it is going on in their life, whether it's stress and addiction, and I'm not advocating that you use them for that, but people make their own choices, I don't think it can be solved. I think management is perhaps the best thing that we could shoot for at this point.
Well, I again advocate to check out some of John Walsh's work at the Washington Office on Latin America. He makes a very strong case for re-examining global drug prohibition and addressing that demand aspect, because of course the demand for drugs seems to be an inevitable part of our world, but the amount of money that's funneled into criminal organizations to meet that demand is not a de facto necessary requirement of those economic factors. So I think looking at, you know, the ways in which U.S. and European drug consumption is financing the destruction and violence of lives in countries like Ecuador is another aspect of the problem that has to be part of the conversation about meaningful solutions.
Ladies and gentlemen, today's episode is also brought to you by Mountain Tough. It's a unique functional fitness program That is, of course, supported by hunters and SEALs and Rangers and those from the special operations community. But that is not my favorite part of the Mountain Tough system or program. Although it was developed with insights from the backcountry hunter and veteran special operations community, there is an emphasis on more than just physical strength, which I believe to be essential. It is also about building an unbreakable mind. It is easy to build muscles from the neck down. It is far more difficult to build muscles from the neck up and the resilience between your ears. The Mountain Tough app provides the best functional fitness program directly to your phone, tablet, TV, or a web browser. So you really don't have an excuse to say, oh, I didn't know what I could be doing or should be doing, whether it's a program or inspiration or insight. It's all right there at the touch of your fingers. Some of you might be saying, well, I'm not a ex-special operations personnel. I'm also not a backcountry hunter. That's okay. For those of you who might not start out as an elite athlete, but you want to improve wherever you may be, Mountain Tough is determined to push everybody's limits. And they're going to meet you where you are with thoughtful programming, helping you achieve elite status through progressive fitness, focusing on longevity, injury prevention, and holistic development. It's a story arc from wherever you are, getting as close to elite as could possibly be. So what are you waiting for? You can join the global Mountain Tough community right now, a community of people transforming their lives, bodies, and minds. Download the Mountain Tough app today and start training to always be ready for whatever it is you're trying to be ready for the backcountry, for the mission, or just life's unexpected challenges. Because when it comes to being prepared, there's no excuse to not start now. You can use the code CHANGE, which I'm looking at all capital letters, one word, at mountaintough.com on the monthly plan to get your first month absolutely free after your 14-day free trial. That's 6 weeks free to dive in, test the waters, the programming, and make sure it's actually for you. What are you waiting for? You can change your life today. Be ready for the mountains, the mission, and just life in general. Ladies and gentlemen, Four Branches Bourbon is the only spirits company founded by veterans from the Army, Navy, Marines, and Air Force. These veterans collaborated with a Bourbon Hall of Fame master distiller and legend to help them make their smooth but complex blend of four-grain and 96-proof bourbon, blended and bottled in Bardstown, Kentucky. It is often said that bourbon without a story is just brown water, and this bourbon has a story with over 100 combined years of military service around the world. At Four Branches, they are not just crafting some of the finest bourbon, but they are reshaping the drinking narrative. Their motto, drink honorably, embodies their ethos of sipping to remember, not to forget. And as veterans, we get to come home while others did not. So if you're going to drink, please drink honorably, and don't drink to forget. But let's sip to remember. And if you are going to sip and you like bourbon, this has a very interesting taste. Not that I'm a bourbon connoisseur or expert, but smoother than I thought it would be. I've had some bourbons that about ripped my face off. This was the exact opposite. So please enjoy honorably. If you want to learn more about Four Branches, please check out their story at fourbranches.com and pick up a bottle of their fine bourbon today using the code IRONCLAD10. That is all one word, iron, normal spelling, C-L-A-D, 10. You're going to get 10% off. What's life like for, I don't know the correct term, but we'll call it an average Ecuadorian, especially outside of one of these port cities? Are they really noticing drastic changes, or is it kind of just life as has been before them?
It really depends on the city. In Quito, there has not been quite the same explosion in homicide and in violence. But in Guayaquil, and I have some friends living in Guayaquil, there really has been a massive change in life. I think particularly on the psychological level, because a city that you've been born into and loved your whole life, one that was quite safe and relaxing and a beautiful city to explore, is a place now where there are random bombings, assassination attempts, shootouts, and really gruesome public displays of force by gangs. And I think that has taken an enormous psychological toll on Ecuadorians. Again, I spoke with Daniela Chacon, the former vice mayor of Quito, and she said that among her and the family and friends close to her, there's a sense of hopelessness that there is no policy that can really address this massive change, that Ecuador has taken a turn down a very dark path that other countries like Colombia and Mexico have already walked, in which gang violence escalates and horrifically impacts the citizenry living in those countries. And I think there's a sense from Daniela Chacón and also from people I know living in Ecuador that there is a very difficult future ahead to which there are no easy solutions.
Two-part question for you. What, when you're looking at Ecuador, what is it or what are you seeing that provides for you the most sense of hope? And then on the other side of that coin, what is it that you are seeing that provides or gives you the greatest sense of concern?
I think there's a fun way to answer that question with one thing, both the greatest sense of hope and the greatest cause for concern. And I think that would be the efforts of Ecuador's Attorney General, Diana Salazar, and her Metastasis operation and investigation. And this is both. So I think Salazar's investigation, which has led to dozens of arrests and really looked at, okay, taking the phone records and the evidence collected off of narco-traffickers and criminal leaders, how can we tie together the series of connections and bribes that have been paid to judges, to prison officials? Where is corruption stemming from? Some of the things revealed in that investigation showed that prosecutors had been paid to delay cases involving prominent gang leaders and to funnel them into specific prisons. That type of work, I think, is one of the most crucial ways in which security can meaningfully be bolstered in Ecuador, because rooting out that corruption and securing the balance and strength of institutions, cracking down on impunity, those are the necessary groundwork to being able to meaningfully address crime instead of just appearing to by making a bunch of arrests and building a new prison and sticking people inside of it. So I think that is one of the things, one of the signs that gives me the most hope in terms of Ecuadorian efforts to combat the problem. But at the same time, it's also one of the worst, most worrying signs, because in the process of that investigation, we've all been able to see how deeply entwined criminal interests, influence, and money are with the security forces, with the legislature, with the judiciary. And I think looking into that, you see how large the problem really is.
Unrelated question that you just kind of spawned for me. How are journalists being treated in Ecuador? Are they being targeted?
Yeah, well, this is, of course, the same sad story as has been visited upon many Latin American countries over the last decades. Ordinary citizens become targets of violence, as do politicians with political assassinations. And journalists are usually not that far behind. And there has been a targeting of journalists by organized crime in Ecuador, which has resulted in absolutely a chilling effect of fear on the investigative reporters upon which Ecuador relies to really understand what's happening in the country and as a check against the corruption that allows organized crime to continue operating. And it has become very scary and quite threatening. Last year, I believe there were USB sticks even mailed to journalists working in the port city of Guayaquil. And at least personally, as a journalist, if I receive a USB stick from an anonymous source, I'm going to look and see what the information on that is in the event that it's an important scoop. And those were jerry-rigged bombs that exploded. And that, I think, is a indicative sign of how sophisticated and how terrifying the operations and attacks of gangs have become. And yes, journalists, of course, are also part of the series of institutions that have to be targeted in order for transnational criminal operations to thrive.
Do you ever worry about your own safety, you know, pointing your own lens and optic at this area of the world and reporting on it?
It depends whether I'm reporting from the ground or not.
That's
I feel
fair.
quite
That's a
safe
fair point.
in my office at home right here. But I think in a larger sense, over the last decade, there has been an enormous rollback in terms of the safety and guarantees provided to journalists across Latin America. I worked in Nicaragua for a number of years and knew a journalist who was murdered during civil conflict there, and a number of journalists who were imprisoned and jailed and physically abused in that country. And I think that's just one example out of many. You can look at what's happened with incredible investigative reporters in El Salvador in the face of critiquing Bukele's security policies and facing reprisals and repercussions there, as well as the continued killing in significant numbers of brave journalists in Mexico. I think across the world, and particularly in Latin America, there has been a shift in terms of the safety and guarantees that journalists can rely on to do their work. They are increasingly seen as valid targets of violence, not only by criminal organizations, but also, I think, very unfortunately, by state actors as well.
Mr. Carl David, I will, in an order to or an attempt to be respectful of your time, I'd like to give you the last word. What would you like to leave people with?
That Ecuador is an important story to continue following. There's a lot of crises and dramatic events in the world, and Ecuador has the world's attention right now because of, these brazen attacks on this television station. But the crisis that Ecuador is experiencing was ongoing before those major news headlines, and it will continue long after it's faded from the news. So I think one of the most important things is to recognize that there is a tragedy and a crisis occurring in that country. And Ecuador is deserving of help and support from its neighbors and from major regional powers that are connected in the issues that are occurring in Ecuador, such as the United States. And that the country should not have to face these kinds of massive challenges alone. A wider approach is necessary.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think we're more interconnected than we would like to believe. It's easy to think that we exist in a vacuum, even in your own personal life. Oh, what's happening to me at this table is not connected to anybody else, and then it cascades downward to a global community. So I definitely agree with what you're saying, and I appreciate you taking the time to provide for me the feedback and insight about Ecuador, and I have no doubt that the listeners will appreciate it as well. I cannot thank you enough for your time. I really do appreciate it.
All right. Have a wonderful day.
If you want to learn more about this issue and stay informed, please visit the International Crisis Group website at crisisgroup.org, or you can follow Carl David's work on Twitter at Charlie Delta Getty Luciak. Thank you again for tuning in to Change Agents, an Ironclad original presented by Montana Knife Company. Looking forward to seeing you all next week with a brand new episode.